This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're in the studios of the library. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Roberta Beery is here with a prize-winning book to share, and I'm crazy about it. What's the title?
Crazy Bitches.
Told you I was, and I'm right in there with you. Tell us what original way you have presented your stories in this book in a way that no one else has.
Well, these are all Hyben stories over 20 years, 2004 through 2024. They've all been published. Many are...
You have to say what Hyben is.
Hyben is prose, a kind of prose poetry or a short story or a flash fiction with haiku, depending on your point of view. It's many things. It originated with Basho in Japan many, many centuries ago, traveled to the deep north. But I had always wanted to do a Hyben collection, and as a woman, I couldn't wait and sit around and wait to be approached.
Oh, that goes for poetry, right?
Right.
Yes. Well, the Hyben is very interesting because it looks like a prose paragraph, but the secret is in the sauce, and that is the haiku at the end, which either distills it or has a slant relationship. So tell us a little bit about what you think a haiku is.
Well, a haiku is a one-breath poem. That's how I think of them. Some people think that they are a painting that you take, you keep in your head, and it resonates for the rest of your life. The haiku are actually very, very hard to write.
The hardest form of poetry.
You cannot just dash them off. And if you're good at prose writing and you want to write Hyben, my advice is to master the haiku form before you go any further.
Before you begin life, because it teaches you to notice things. Now, Bob Ertman is my group leader in our haiku group, and this is the way we go. We say it has to be an image. Now, you're going to help me with this. The first line has to be an image, not a thought, not a belief, and it has to be something you can taste, smell, or see. The second line has to be something about the first line, and then the third line fans it out philosophically. Now, my understanding is that it cannot have a feeling state, a thought, an idea, an emotion, an understanding. It has got to be the image. Now, is that right?
Well, the way I think of it is it's a concrete, not abstract. So you don't fool around with abstract ideas. You don't say,
I remember.
Love, death, big concepts. Haiku is more compact than that, and it has to be, Bob Ertman gave you a good guide. Once you master that, then you can break those rules.
Yes, because I noticed that sometimes you go slant in a haiku, and
yes,
an impression. Okay, so that is, I've been waiting my whole life to ask you that, and I know that you're the haiku queen in America. Everyone thinks you're the roving haiku master, right?
Ambassador for the Haiku Foundation.
Imagine. So. Well, let us hear a poem from Crazy Bitches.
Grief, the uncut version. Childhood desk. I trace initials no longer mine. Life is a scratchy film reel that plays in your head. Your mother swanning into the solarium that overlooks the pool. Life is her eyeing you from her love seat perch. On her lap, pink crocheted squares and the latest Dick Francis. Life is you laughing when she says, Roberta, all kidding aside, you could stand to lose a few pounds, maybe eat more salads. And even though you will sell the Florida condo, life is spending an hour looking at its staged photos, zooming in on what your mother calls the solarium, and you call the sunroom, just to hear her brusque correction. Life is the warmth of the sun on your face as you curl up under her afghan no one else wants, while reading Dick Francis for the umpteenth time. Life is letting the book fall from your hands as you close your eyes, a scratchy film reel playing in your head, your mother swanning into the sunroom, solarium, sunroom, solarium, sunroom. 10 years gone, clouds shift, a broken stairway.
Would you just read that haiku one more time?
10 years gone, clouds shift, a broken stairway.
So that haiku can either distill the haibun or can reflect on it. But the portrait of the woman tells us everything. First, it tells us she's going to be no help navigating you through life. No help whatsoever. And the self-absorption done in pink, done in Dick Francis, that's a masterful. I think that when I read the book, that was my favorite poem. I'm so glad you started with that one. But the relationship is there, and it's painful, but you keep a little humor in it. And I want to point out, when people say, how do you write a prose poem? The lyricism is there. The repetition is there. Everything is in there. So I'm so glad we have that as an imprimatur. Now, I want them to know that you're the winner of the Bridgeport Poetry Prize, and your work has appeared in the best of American periodicals. Your short story collection, The Unworn Necklace, was a finalist in the Poetry Society of America Book Award and a first for a book of haiku. Roberta Beery's haiku and haibun, Deflection, was named a National Poetry Month Best Pick by the Washington Independent Review. You co-edited Wishbone Moon, an international anthology of haiku by women, and the women, and the first haiku collection, Carousel, won the Snapshot Press Prize. Okay, I'm tired. You received the finalist book award from the Haiku Society of America and the Haiku Foundation, and I'm stopping right there out of fatigue. But all of those things you have earned. Nothing was given to you. I know how hard you've worked over the years, and you are unrelentingly productive. We're so proud to have you here. Let's hear another poem.
I'd like to read Pompeii, which is a poem that was selected by Alexis Rotella for her Dream Anthology.
She's pretty wonderful, too.
Yes, she was. Pompeii. My brother and I link arms and walk the length of a small wood. He stops, strips off his top, and dips it in a cistern. Midday heat, the scorched tips of olive leaves. For a moment, father is alive, the whip poised in his hand. Scars on my brother's back burn my eyes. Birdsong stirring a crater of emptiness. A fire blazes in the distance. When we hear Vesuvius's roar, it is too late. Still we run, hand in hand. Day moon weaving its way through clouds of light.
First of all, when you read it, we notice when you lower your voice, we are getting a very beautiful commentary on a very harsh poem. Those interwoven lyrical lines, midday heat, the scorched tips of olive trees, and then birdsong stirring a crater of emptiness, and finally, day moon weaving its way through clouds of light. Those are so restorative because they change ugliness. They change ugliness with beauty. And that's your whole, that's the reason you are so well loved. Now, abuse, is it a tie that binds?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Because nobody but you two knew what it was like.
Right.
Yeah. And that
and
follows
it was denied also.
Yes. Well,
by the adults.
It's the only ally you have, really. Let's keep going because this is a porthole into your work. Let's have another.
The next one is And So Between Them Both You See, which is some people say I only go dark. So this is my, what I like to think of as one of my humorous haibun. And so between them both you see. Jack Spratt has grown increasingly worried about his missus. She tried all the fad diets, but the food chatter in her head persisted. Her thoughts always on her next meal, which made Jack crazy. "You'll eat us out of house and home," he remonstrated. Bickering crows, he decides not to ask. Jack was a man of few desires and could have lived happily on beans and toast and an apple for dessert. Still, the Spratts loved each other. When word came about an injectable that would silence the food chatter, his wife went straight to her GP. "Sign me up," she demanded. Within a month, she had lost one stone, and within 3 months, she slipped on her decades-old wedding gown. Jack was delighted at first, but came to dislike his new glamorous wife, her weight loss videos, her 5 million followers. It was grand for Mrs. Spratt at first, but the millions lost interest when her beautiful round face turned gaunt and wrinkly, and she was unable to hide her baggy skin folds from the camera. Love charm, bits of blue thread also unraveling. "I don't know who you are anymore," Jack told his emaciated missus. His wife was no fool. She went to her GP. "Stop the injectables," she demanded. Almost immediately, the Spratts were back to their old ways, licking the plate clean between them. Bliss returned to their household under the watchful eye of the GP, who ordered a healthy lifestyle and 10,000 steps a day. The 5 million followers returned, which prompted even more fame, this time for Jack, too. Likely you've seen their new reality series, Fat and Lean, A Recipe for Love. Cherry blossom rain, the swish, swish, swish of a dishcloth.
If a dishcloth can get in a haiku, we know you can do anything. Everyone must stop immediately what they're doing and go and run and buy this book. Go to Amazon, get Crazy Bitches, because I want you to see how this is presented. This haibun is actually one and then a haiku, another and then a haiku, a third and then a haiku, a final haiku. So it is a sequence of haiku and haibun that make a fiction. And I just want to say, are relationships possible?
Well, the Spratts worked it out.
They did. So the big theme there is compromise.
The big theme is don't believe the latest cures for what you think ails you, and trust your instincts.
This is really a satire on consumerism.
Yes, it is, and vanity.
And influencers.
And influencers.
But why did they manage to navigate through together in this presentation?
Well, I used the nursery rhyme as my, you know, basis. Jack Spratt could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean, and so between them both, you see, they lick the platter clean. So I always knew that they were going to stay together.
But you know, there is a message in this. This is deep. This is deep. It shows that you have to give a little and get a little and give a little and get a little. But it is very funny.
Thank you.
It is very funny.
I also want to mention, if you're in the D.C. environs, Wonderland Books in Bethesda is carrying actual physical copies of Crazy Bitches.
I hope so. And I hope they're off the shelf by the time we're off the air. This is absolutely a book that will... has everything in it. It has beauty, it has sadness, it has tears, it has laughter, it's got craziness, and it has bitches.
Right, it has family photos, everything. And it has artwork by my brother Kevin Beery.
That's right.
And
it the photos, the ekphrastic ones.
Yes.
It's got everything. Well,
I'm actually going to read one of those now, Irish Twins, if that's...
Yes, read it now.
Irish Twins. We share an attic room. In the corner is an old double bed that smells and sags on one side, my side. Late at night, I hear my heartbeat loud. So loud, he will hear it. He will think my heart is calling him up the attic stairs. His footsteps are heavy. He smells of Old Spice and cherry tobacco. My eyes shut tight. I know he is there. I feel his weight. Never on my side, always on the side she sleeps. When the bed springs sing their sad song, I fly away up to the ceiling. My sister is already there. Together we hold hands. Looking down, we see our bodies. We are not moving. We are as still as the dead. Attic rain, the backyard swing off kilter.
If there were a Nobel Prize, that's the poem. The problem with it is you wrote it, but every time the reader reads it, it's as if it's just happening. That is the power. Every time you read this poem, it is happening again now as you read it. That's why I get an upset stomach every time I read it. How did you, at what moment did you say, I am going to talk and tell the truth and nothing but the truth? And then you found self-redemption and courage and freedom. What was the moment that you said, wait a minute, I can deal with this?
Well, there was a lot of therapy involved. I've got to credit specialized therapists that deal with this kind of, let's call it what it is, incest.
But to lead you toward writing?
Well, there in therapy, there's often this idea of writing a letter to either a living or deceased person telling your truth. And so I had written many letters. This didn't just come out of nowhere. This came out of memories that I wasn't sure were real. I could not have them validated by anybody. I remember them very clearly. But, you really have to believe in your own truth to write this kind of thing, especially
because illusion wants to hide it from you.
And yeah. There's family pressure, and there's extended family naysayers, and there's a lot going on. But this poem, when I read this one in presentations, this is the one where men and women come up to me at the end and tell me their truths.
That is freeing for everyone. One thing about the way it works as a poem is that it is consequential from the beginning, because when you hear those footsteps, that is when my whole body reacts. It's the footsteps. And from the footsteps, you lead into one thing after another. So it also builds intention, and then it becomes sublime. What more do you want from a work of art?
Grace, I'd like to say I don't hear those footsteps anymore.
I know, but
but
you,
every so often
but
I do.
You help others with them, yeah. But I know you don't, because you're as whole and well as anyone I know. But you have done a service, and I think you know it.
Thank
also,
you.
It's a work of art. I mean, art isn't pretty. Art is not always pretty.
Well, life is messy.
Well, I'll have that on my tombstone. Let us hear another from Roberta Beery. I might as well just give one more credential. Her recent chapbook, The Heart of Heibun, is available as a free download.
Yes.
How generous, at Button Hook Press. And her short poems, I love this, have appeared on tea bottles, calendars, buses, quilts, paintings, and postcards. Roberta Beery believes haiku is the best free medicine in the world.
Yes.
And you dispense it every day. Let's have a haibun.
Okay. This one is Rosemary for Remembrance. And there is a studio photograph from maybe 100 years ago, no, more than 100 years ago, of my Irish grandmother, Alice O'Neill, on the opposite page. Rosemary for Remembrance. He doesn't know. We don't tell him his body is failing. Instead, we bring him what he requests. It's little enough. His spectacles, favorite tweed cap, a faded portrait of his mother. We never knew her. She died before we were born. A daughter named after his mother was never considered. Too old-fashioned, he was told, the one time he mentioned it. And now that it is too late, he says it would have meant so much to hear his mother's name live on in one of us. Open drawer, deep in the sachet's scent, forgotten song. We keep watch, wait for him to beckon us one by one. He opens his arms, calls us by her name, takes his last breath, which is where the story ends, and then begins. This year, 15 years after his death, there is a new baby. She shares a name with her great-grandmother. See, it's written right here in the baby journal her mother keeps. Curlew song, all the way home, the circular path.
I forgot to mention your haibun are always in the present.
Yes, I try to do that. I think it makes them more impactful.
I think it makes the immediacy work because we're right there, especially when, see, it's written right here. The reason this poem puzzled me is because, first of all, you gave your father his humanity in this poem.
I don't believe in the 100% monsters.
Obviously, but that shows your decency. That shows your decency. And that is what makes us know that people are complex and that there is room for allowing life, even among the wretched. And there's so much grace in this poem where there's so much, like, it's very hard for the reader not to judge the characters. And I don't think you, as the author, do.
I try to just display what is
right.
happening.
And it occurs to me that if you judge them, we would not. And that is a really important element in art. I mean, it's like the person on stage that cries, we just watch them. But if they imply tears, then we cry. So these works are extremely, extremely moving for the reader. And they're so beautifully made that it doesn't hurt to read them. Well, you don't condemn anything that lives. Let's go on to something else. Roberta Beery.
The next one is called The Story of the Woman in the Poster. Virginia turns on the gas lamp as dust settles on cobblestones. She moves to her window seat, watches the fairies dancing in the blue flame. She doesn't question what she sees, the time for questioning passed 10 days ago, when the voices came back. She prepares her writing, instruments, and paper. No need for further discussions about her state of mind. No need for Leonard suggesting she try a new treatment for what can't be cured or endured. Always a careful writer, she spends the next hour composing the letter to her husband. She signs it with her familiar flourish, dotting all three I's, then wills herself to stare at the fairies, dancing in the flame. But the letter won't let her be. Virginia feels its weight in her pocket, as heavy as a bag of stones. River walk, the white space between words.
Tell the audience what Virginia Woolf did.
Well, besides, I believe, writing the first book of Stream of Consciousness and writing many wonderful novels, she ultimately killed herself by drowning herself. And she did, as I understand it, put stones in her pockets.
That's what the historians tell us. You know, lots of women do things like this. And we don't write poems about them because we don't know who they are. How many are abused? How many are beaten? How many are mistreated? How many commit suicide? How many murder their husbands out of revenge? But those are the nameless people, but she represents them.
Yes, and I also feel a certain affinity with her after reading her biography, which came out many years ago. I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Harold Nicholson. I have to check that, but she was abused by her stepbrothers, she and her sister, Vanessa. And once I knew that, it's like a puzzle. All the pieces yes. fall into place.
It is true. And to be not a celebrity, but to be such a great translator of the human consciousness, and to lose that, it's all big. It is all big. So I'm glad that you gave her one more kiss in yes. this poem, immortalized her one more time in your way, like no one else can do that. And we will have another poem from this book, Crazy Bitches. Which, in your constellation of books, what number book is this? Your 10th?
I haven't gotten to 10th yet. I think it's number, it's either 6th or 7th.
Well, you'll get to 10th by tomorrow if I know you. More, please.
This is called Somewhat of a Sad Perplexity, and the title is taken from Tintern Abbey, Wordsworth. Claire McQueen, who put this together for me and published the book, is very good at crediting things like that. She got me to do a lot of more work. Summer of Me at 15. My brother smoking pot while our parents are at a political dinner for the other party, which we despise. I close my eyes and wait my turn, listen to the Blue Raincoat song on my mother's record player, smuggled into my brother's bedroom. By me, I remind him. He hands me what's left in the roach clip. Bay window, a feral cat claws the view. Summer of me as an orphan. Even though we never talk about it, my brother has aged into a bumper sticker supporter of the other party. My husband says he likes my brother, but it's the principle of the thing. What about your cousins? I ask. For them, it's about tax breaks, but he's a true believer, my husband says. My brother messages a link to an Italian cover of the Blue Raincoat song. I message back three yellow smiley faces. My phone pings. A red pulsating heart stares up at me. My brother's first emoji. Broken window. Sunlight slips through unarmed.
Summer, here we have the complexity again.
Summer of me as an expat. My husband's listening to the latest polls. The other party is ahead. I call my brother. He tells the story again, father punishing us with the strap, mother deaf to our cries. That's when I realized we were on our own, he says. Did you know the Blue Raincoat was a Burberry, I ask. My brother switches the call to video. He's wearing the Aaron sweater I sent and stroking his gray beard. Tell me more, he says. Windowpane, the ants march 2x2.
For me, that is a poem about crossing the distance between then and now and back then again, because your other poems reveal that you have a close relationship now with your brother.
We do.
And so once again, you show that there's more than one stripe in everyone, and you don't judge.
Well, so many families have become polarized, and it's sad because people who were once siblings who were once close don't speak to each other anymore. And friends who were once close don't speak to each other anymore. And I wanted to show what I was really trying to show in this poem by showing and not telling is that go back to what brought you close. Keep that going.
Let us have a final poem.
The final one is from the book Crazy Bitches goes in reverse chronological order. Mm. So this is one of my
I didn't notice that.
Early ones that I just happen to like. Now, it is kind of in the past tense. It has a photo of me at 15 on the opposite page by my friend Arlette. Arlette, with whom I went to high school.
It looks like a jeans jacket.
It's one of those fringe jackets. I loved it.
Oh, right.
It didn't keep me
warm.
What
year was it?
Yeah, it was about 1969. 70.
That's right, a fringe jacket.
It was not made for warmth, and I froze a lot, but I just thought I looked fabulous in it, so I wore it quite a bit. Barfly. I was just a kid in those days, and he was one of the bad boys the nuns warn you about. And my old man told me stay far away from that one, but I couldn't help myself. And when I saw him, he was walking up to me with his Marlboros tucked under his T-shirt like Marlon Brando with those biceps. And his hair smelled of his last smoke, and he kissed me, one of those long kisses that just ooze out of you and shake up your insides at the same time. But what did I know back then? Not enough. Which is why he'll always be the one that got away. Last call. A ceiling fan stirs the tip jar.
Everyone has gone through that, but when you read this book, it's as if no one else but you ever went through that. That is your gift. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, and friends of the program, Natalie Canivore, Yung Ki Kim Reno, Avi Deshashani, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Sandy Kinlock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.